You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Didn't slavery in the United States end when President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation? Well, as Kevin Bales and Rod Sutalter reveal in their new book, slavery remains very much alive in this country, and it touches the food we eat and the clothes we wear. The Slave Next Door, Human Trafficking and Slavery in America Today, is published by University of California Press, and I'm pleased that it has brought Kevin Bales and Ron Sutalter to our show today. Welcome back, and Kevin, welcome back, Kevin. It's a pleasure to meet you, Ron.
Thank you.
You argue that some Americans actually live next door to slaves. Your title says that. How is that possible? Wouldn't their neighbors be aware of something like that?
Well, there was actually a case last month, Leonard, in Pound Ridge, which is only about 40 miles north of here, where a man was arrested for sex and labor trafficking, for advertising for and bringing into his home foreign women whom he forced to work for free and to perform sexual favors.
So did they know there was a brothel next door?
No brothel at all. This is a private home. Mm-hmm. And it seems it had been going on, according to the police, for around 7 years. He had been victimizing foreign-born women. And when the neighbors found out not only that slavery exists, but it existed in their town, on their street, and in the house next door, they were absolutely flabbergasted.
When we talk about slavery, are we talking about something similar to what happened in this country before the Civil War?
We're actually talking about something that's almost exactly the same. The key difference is that it's not legal anymore. But if you look at what slavery's about, it's about one person completely controlling another person. They use violence to maintain that control. They exploit them economically. And the person can't walk away. They've lost their free will.
Well, Ron talked about foreign-born slaves. Is that the most typical type in this country?
It is typical that what we call human trafficking, the process of moving someone into a situation of slavery, is common in the United States and in Western Europe as well, as people are desperate and give in to the blandishments of recruiters and then are tricked and enslaved. But it's also true that there are people who are what we would call them indigenous Americans who are caught up in slavery too.
Tricked into it as well?
Yes.
Exactly. Forced into it. What industries do slaves typically work in? You mentioned sex, the sex trade. What else?
Well, the sex trade is the largest proportion, but it's not even the majority. The second largest is, in fact, domestic servants. So very often the very ones that are living next door to people without their knowledge. After that, agricultural workers represent maybe 10 to 15% of those enslaved in the U.S. And after that, there are so many different kinds of amazing criminal creative minds that put slaves to work in places you'd never guess.
Well, since slavery is illegal, why don't these people just escape?
Well, the simple answer is that there's a whole raft of forces that hold them in that situation. The first is, of course, the violence that is used to take control of them and the threat of violence, and often the threat of violence to their families back home. They say, if you try to get away, we're going to kill your parents back home. We know where they live. There's also sleep deprivation, food deprivation, terror that creates a psychological enslavement. And then they don't speak the language, and they don't know where they are. And you roll those together, and it makes a chain around the brain of the person. It makes it very difficult to get away.
Well, I'm sure there are listeners who are saying, that could never happen to me. I would never put up with that kind of treatment. Does it take a certain psychological mindset to allow yourself to become a slave?
I wouldn't say so, in that I think if the average listener was pounded over the head with a baseball bat, starved, not allowed to sleep for 5 or 6 days, they would become sufficiently malleable that someone might be able to enslave them.
You begin the book with the story of Sandra Bearden. Can you tell us a bit about her, Ron?
Sandra Bearden was a housewife and a mother in Laredo, Texas, who decided she wanted a housekeeper. So she traveled.
Well, she was a Mexican-American.
She was a Mexican-American. She traveled down to Mexico and spoke with the parents of a 12-year-old girl named Maria. She promised the parents that she would give Maria a good job with an education and a good home if they would allow her to take her to El Norte. And in point of fact, when she got Maria to her house, she put this child into a horrific situation of domestic slavery, beating her, torturing her, chaining her to a pole in the backyard.
Now, she was, as we said, a Mexican-American and a mother as well. And yet you had no empathy for Maria and Maria's situation?
It's a deep psychological question. What allows a person to descend into as what we call a spiral of control, to allow for such incredible cruelty, especially to a child?
Did she ever explain how she could justify it?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And this went on and on and on, and the child would have stayed in servitude in that horrible condition much longer had there not been a next-door neighbor working on his roof who looked over the wall and saw a child literally chained to a pole in the back.
And Maria, even if she hadn't been chained, probably couldn't have done anything because she was underage?
She was underage, she was underfed, she was undernourished, and she was beaten and subjected to the point of psychological subservience.
And what would her legal status have been in this country? Did she have a visa?
As I understand it, no. She was slipped into the country across the border in Sandra Bjornsson's car and that sort of thing. If she had been found, and well, she was found ultimately by police, but her legal status under federal law would have been that she had been granted a what's called a T visa. So she would have been safe that way, not deported. But in fact, her family chose to take her home.
But visas are a major part of this whole thing because the kind of visa they get will affect their possibility of freedom.
The federal government allows for 5,000 of what Kevin refers to as T visas, allowing victims, survivors of human trafficking, to stay in this country per year.
But that's after the fact.
After they're found.
Many of these people are coming in with, what is it, a J-1 visa?
Well, those visas, both the J visas and the H visas, sadly, are something of an open back door to slavery in the United States. The J visas have to do with nannies and household servants. We have special provisions for European young women who want to come be nannies.
Au pairs,
with monitoring and watching and orientation classes and regular contact. But if you happen to be the same young woman from, say, West Africa and want to come be brought in as a nanny or au pair, you don't qualify for that program. You come under a J, in which case they take a look at you at the airport and they never see you again, which means anyone can take control of your life.
So to some degree, this is a roll of the dice. You could come here and be treated perfectly well and have a great experience, go back home and talk about how America was so wonderful for you as an au pair or as a domestic.
Mm-hmm. Or as an agricultural worker in the same way.
Yeah.
That's right.
And then others will come here and find themselves trapped. So it's really a matter of who brings you in. And does money tend to exchange hands when slavery is involved?
Very often people are paying for the right to be brought into the country, not knowing that they're going to be enslaved.
So they're paying to be enslaved. This is different than the slavery before the Civil War, where people were stolen from their homes.
Overwhelmingly, the people who are foreign nationals who are trafficked into slavery in this country are trafficked by paying their life savings and then going into debt, Leonard, to people who make them promises that they have no intention of keeping. And so when they arrive here, they find themselves in debt, and rather than facing opportunity, they find themselves in slavery.
My guests are Kevin Bales, who is the president of Free the Slaves, an organization in Washington, D.C., professor of sociology at Roehampton University in London, England, and the author of another book on slavery, the one that brought him here earlier, Disposable People. And also with us is Ron Sidhalter, historian, folklorist, and lecturer, and author of a number of other books, including books that deal with the Civil War. They have collaborated on The Slave Next Door, Human Trafficking and Slavery in America Today, published by the University of California Press. You mentioned that some of the slaves are Native Americans, people born in this country. How does one become a slave under those circumstances?
Well, the government estimates in the hundreds of thousands the number of children, American-born children and adolescents, who are at risk of being caught in slavery on an annual basis. And the type of slavery they're referring to is primarily sexual coercion.
So it's mostly women?
Mostly children, female, children and adolescents. And they are stolen or they are seduced by pimps, by smooth-talking traffickers on the streets of their own cities and towns.
So this is illegal, but how does the federal government define human trafficking?
Well, it's actually treated under the law as a specific category called human trafficking, but that actually reflects the old laws that have to do with slavery. So it's about complete control of a person, coercion taking that control, using them for economic gain and profit and so forth. The twists under new laws that came in 2000 are just that if it's a child who's been brought in and put into any kind of sexual exploitation or other kinds of exploitation, they're automatically treated as if they are fully enslaved and trafficked.
So there are differences if you are in being trafficked in sex and if you're being trafficked in another kind of labor, even if the labor trafficking is totally horrendous.
Not necessarily any large differences in that.
Well, Maria, for example, there was no sexual component to that. Her slavery, was there?
Well, there was, in fact, a very horrific rape of Maria with garden tools by Sandra Bjørnson. So,
what, to keep her under control?
Well, it's hard to know why anyone would do anything that terrible, but there was that kind of a sexual part to it.
It's difficult to try and draw a distinction by saying there's no sexual abuse in other forms of trafficking because so many do feature that. If a woman is a domestic or if someone is working in the fields, there's always the possibility that that woman is going to be sexually abused by her traffickers.
Okay, so a woman escapes and she says she finds herself in the police station. She hardly speaks English. Or a man. And there's also sex trafficking with boys, isn't there?
Of course.
And says to the police, I have been held captive here. I've been... And I've escaped. Is that person going to get good treatment?
Now we're into the crapshoot.
Yeah, one of the biggest problems we're facing these days, Leonard, is the fact that our local police and state police have not been sufficiently trained or sensitized, A, to recognize what a slavery situation looks like, and B, how to address and help the person who has been enslaved. For example, as Kevin mentioned, minors are automatically, in prostitution, considered trafficking victims. However, if a policeman sees an underage girl prostituting on a street corner, there's a very good chance he's going to arrest her without considering that she might be working under coercion. And so she's victimized three times.
Well, isn't it likely if she's underage that she was coerced into doing this?
We would like to think so. Unfortunately, the police do not always see it that way. And so she's victimized by the system, victimized by the Johns, and victimized by the trafficker, and the cycle continues. We desperately need more and better training for local and state police.
Well, what should they be looking for? Are there certain guidelines that would indicate that this is a case of slavery?
Yes, there are a number of guidelines. You can look in some ways just when you meet someone that you suspect in that situation. Are they fearful? Do they look bruised? Are they concerned? If you can speak to them, ask if they've ever been paid, do they have freedom of movement? What happened to their documents? One of the key indicators is if someone's taken their passports away and won't let them have it back.
But I'd also assume that there are a lot of people who are in total fear and won't cooperate for one reason or another. I'm sure that it's hard to get some of these kids to cooperate. And if somebody has lost a visa or has been told, as you said earlier, that relatives back home will be killed, that they're not going to cooperate.
That's true. A lot of the victims of sexual coercion, for example, suffer from a deep sense of shame. Slavery victims in general will suffer from shame. Men, because it's so damaging to their self-image to think they have been in a slavery situation. Women who have been sexually abused, these may be very religious women. And the idea of not only sharing this information but personally confronting it can be a devastating experience for a woman or a young girl.
Which is why that training is so crucial.
Yes.
So that's the sensitive response to that kind of crime victim. We've got that pretty much around the United States with victims of sexual assault.
In the 60s, cops were rather insensitive. And
absolutely.
Then women complained, and they started setting up sensitivity training, and certain people were sent out in cases of rape. Mm-hmm. But that's not happened with slavery?
It's happening, but we're right at the beginning.
It's very much an ongoing struggle, and we're at the get-go.
My guests are Kevin Bales and Ron Sarodo. Their book, The Slave Next Door, Human Trafficking and Slavery in America Today, published by the University of California Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Kevin Bales and Rod Sidalter. Their book, The Slave Next Door, Human Trafficking and Slavery in America Today, published by the University of California Press. How many people are estimated to be in slave situations in this country?
In this country, the State Department estimates that about 17,000 foreign nationals are trafficked into the United States from at least 35 countries and enslaved here every year. Now, this doesn't take into account, as we discussed earlier, the number of American citizens.
But we're saying 17,000 a year. So at this point, it could be hundreds of thousands of people.
We don't know, but a conservative estimate would be at least 40,000 to 50,000 foreign nationals enslaved here as we speak.
And are they treated differently than if it were an American?
Not necessarily. As you look across the cases, the treatment of American nationals or foreign nationals is pretty horrific in any direction. In fact, anywhere you look at slavery around the world, the violence is the key theme to that, and they suffer terribly.
So we talked about law enforcement, and you do have a case of a cop who had been trained what to look for, and he was able to help a woman who had escaped a domestic trafficking situation. But does it really take other kinds of people, for example, non-governmental organizations, to get this thing going seriously?
There's an entire network of service providers and victim advocates across the country, Leonard, who are trained and ready to address the issue and help victims and survivors. The big problem is locating the cases. And on top of that, the really big problem is a lack of awareness, not just on the part of law enforcement and public officials, but on the part of American citizens as well, as to what slavery is and the fact that it actually exists in this country today.
Well, Kevin, you are with one of those organizations. Do you sometimes have difficulty getting the cooperation of law enforcement and government agencies?
Yes, I'm afraid sometimes that's the case. And I have to say, it's also unfortunate that some of the federal agencies don't cooperate with you. They don't play well with other agencies. And it's sort of well known among the service providers to victims of trafficking that you have to be very careful as you play the game of working with the different agencies.
Which agencies would be?
Justice Department versus FBI versus Immigration and Customs Enforcement versus Department of Labor. I mean, they'll all get into a wrestling match if you're not careful.
Yeah. Well, right now, all of the nonprofits are having a hard time getting funding. Is that a big issue here as well?
It certainly can be, and especially for the local groups that provide the services. Our organization is actually global, and there's an increasing awareness of this crime. We're not in such trouble, but those who provide shelters at the local level are often most in need.
Do they get government funding?
They can do. There are a number of government programs that do put those funds out there. But under the last administration, a number of those funds weren't cut off, but they were restricted so that an individual victim of slavery in the United States was restricted to a fixed sum that would be their allocation for rehabilitation. And the trouble was that it meant that the providers had to make horrible choices, like, do I give this woman medical care or psychiatric care? Do I help her get an education or give her legal help?
Was that something that Congress did, or was that something that the Bush administration did as part of its policy?
If I remember correctly, it was through regulation and policy.
And did you get any sense of a justification for that? I can't imagine any government, Republican, Democrat, or anything else, justifying human trafficking.
It's not that they justify human trafficking. It's that they make determinations based on little to no information. For example, how much time should we allocate to the servicing of a trafficking victim? And they come up with an arbitrary period of 6 months, whereas a person who's been victimized in slavery could very well need years to the rest of that person's life.
Have we seen a change with the Obama administration?
It's a little soon to tell, Leonard. President Obama has made all the right sounds, and he has appointed a wonderful man as ambassador at large and head of the Trafficking in Persons Office. We do know that under the Bush administration, there were many, many omissions.
Yesterday, in a discussion of slow foods, we talked about the coalition of Immokalee workers and their fight against slavery, or in some cases, people who are indentured, which is pretty much the same thing, isn't it? And you say that slavery exists in the agricultural industry in fairly widespread way. Where are these slaves being used?
For the most part, you find that there have been slavery cases. There were 7 successfully adjudicated cases in Southwest Florida alone. The government refers to South Florida as ground zero for slavery in the United States today. You find that people are enslaved in the fields by individual traffickers, by foremen, by crime families, by syndicates. It's an open field.
And there are agribusinesses bringing them in knowingly?
I don't believe they're bringing them in knowingly, but I think that when the big growers and the buyers are saying that they're not aware it's going on, I think there's a lot of dissembling going on.
Does this tend to be on the larger farms?
There have been cases. As a matter of fact, this year, in February, a family called the Navarretes in South Florida were sentenced for trafficking 12 Mexican and Guatemalan workers for a three-year period on the fields of two of Florida's largest tomato growers, 6Ls and Pacific.
And I imagine that this does keep the prices of the produce down.
It really doesn't have that much of an impact on the price of produce, whether you're talking about slave labor or worker abuse. It's an insidious way for people who see an opportunity to make a buck.
Isn't the guest worker program intended to prevent this sort of thing?
The guest worker program has, since it was established in 1943, provided a pretty open field for worker abuse and, in some cases, slavery. A perfect example is Florida, where you have only two government inspectors for the entire south section of the state. And just because a contractor promises to provide home and food and good pay to a worker doesn't mean he's going to follow through. And with nobody there to check on him, that worker is locked in to that particular contractor with no option for escape.
And Florida is where the Immokalee workers group
They are
started.
Based in Immokalee, Florida. That's correct.
How did that come about?
It came about through some workers who had originally been in a slavery situation and got together and determined to form their own workers group. And in the years in which they have been around, they have been successful in tracking down slavery situations and traffickers and have been part and parcel of the government's prosecutions in the past.
And they have pushed for boycotts of the produce that is created through slave labor, but you suggest boycotts don't always work.
Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. In the case of the Immokalee workers, the boycott worked very well. Taco Bell refused to come to the bargaining table to sign that they would no longer buy produce picked by abused or enslaved workers. And so for 4 years, the coalition boycotted, marched, camped on Taco Bell's corporate front lawn, and brought the message to the college campuses. And after 4 years, Taco Bell signed, as ultimately did such fast food outfits as Long John Silver, A&W, McDonald's, and most recently Burger King.
And they're all agreeing to not. I would think that would just be good PR for those companies.
I think they've made it good PR, yes.
My guests are Kevin Bales and Ron Sudoter. Their book, The Slave Next Door, Human Trafficking and Slavery in America Today, published by the University of California Press. Well, why do you think that Taco Bell held out so long? Just because they were being loyal to their suppliers?
I think the fact that the coalition, among its demands, was asking for a penny more a pound on tomatoes impacted Taco Bell to the extent that they didn't want to have to pay the extra money and didn't feel that this little group of workers was strong enough to bring enough pressure to bear to force them to do so.
Now, we've been hearing about the same sort of thing with foreign workers, and foreign workers who sometimes work for 15, 16 cents an hour and want 18 cents an hour, and their employers are pressured by the American company. I'm not going to mention any names, but we all know about a few of those places, and then resist paying the foreign workers. Is that any better or any different than what's going on in this country?
It's similar, but those are situations in which the sweatshop workers are in fact paid workers, even though it's 15 cents an hour, and they can in fact choose often to walk away, even into a worse situation. However, there are plenty of people who are captured into slavery producing commodities that flow into our products as well by American companies.
Such as the things that sweatshops produce?
Often the raw materials flow into the sweatshops, and a classic is cotton. On three continents, we have slave labor in cotton production. The entire
That's because cotton is so hard to harvest, isn't it?
That's part of it. But it's also because some landowners in South Asia, for example, or West Africa, are able to enslave local farmers to operate their plots. But then we also have the problem with the government of Uzbekistan, which basically uses their entire high school population as forced labor for their main export. They export 30% of the world's cotton. And the UN and everyone else has said this is a kind of enslavement, this is a kind of forced labor, because there's no payment and there's no choice by these high schoolers about picking that cotton.
So in this country, most slavery is either domestics, agricultural, or sexual.
Those are the big three, but there are also a number of other areas in which people are enslaved. And as Kevin and I discovered to our amazement in writing this book, there are areas in which traffickers have enslaved people that defy the imagination. For example, last year in Las Vegas, an entire Chinese acrobatic troupe was enslaved. And a few years before that...
I mean, they were performing every night?
They were made to do two performances a day for no pay. When they weren't performing, their keeper was farming them out to another man to work on houses or do yard work at no pay. A few years before that, an African boys' choir was trafficked into slavery by a minister in Texas. And at one point, there were dozens of deaf Mexicans being made to sell trinkets in a slavery situation in both New York City and Chicago. It's all the innovativeness of the trafficker.
I've met Peruvian workers enslaved in a cannoli factory on Long Island. I've met Cameroonian women enslaved in braiding and hair and nail shops in New Jersey. Right. It's kind of a if there's an empty niche, a clever criminal will rush in to fill it if they can.
And there would be no way for me to ever spot that, would there? Unless the person told me I am being held captive.
Only if you were to open your sensitivity, look at the situation, see if someone seemed fearful, pick up on some of the warning signs that we list in the book, of course.
Yeah.
And then perhaps, if you can, ask that question. And if you can't ask that question, perhaps call a hotline or call a local police station and say, someone might just want to check on this situation.
Well, what are some of the telltale signs?
Well, there's the fearfulness and the signs of physical abuse, whether or not the person has ever received pay. You can ask sometimes if you have a chance, you know, do you get paid in this job? How long have you been here? How did you come? Do you still have your documents? Because that's one of the key signs of it. And often that story, if you're sympathetic, will pour out to you. Often you or Leonard said it a moment ago, they're very fearful, though, and they're not wanting to speak. And that's why it's important to, for example, use the national hotline. I'll give the number if you like. It's 888-3737-888, which will take you to a unit in Washington, which will then refer it back to local service providers and experts.
That's a toll-free number.
If you're not sure that what you're looking at might be a slavery situation, we've also listed several of the NGOs and service providers that we mentioned before. Call one of them. Find out if you're looking at telltale signs. Find out what to do from there.
I've always wondered about those ads that I see in the back of newspapers like the Village Voice for, call and spend some time with an Asian woman, for example. I'm assuming that in many cases we're talking about this very thing, human sex trafficking.
In case after case, there have been.
So wouldn't the cop just call the numbers and go there and start arresting people?
Well, they certainly could do. They certainly could call the numbers and go there and investigate and then arrest people if they were disposed to do so. And it's really then a question of political will and whether or not the citizens of Manhattan or the citizens of any state are willing to say, we'd like to have our law enforcement look a little more closely into this.
It's kind of odd because we are really concerned when the person is underage. And then once that person is over 18, well, you know, that's just the way the world is. So she was sold by somebody in Moldavia and wound up in some brothel in Queens, and that's okay?
Well, it's not okay, obviously. And, of course, the fact that people turn 18 doesn't make it suddenly that they have consented to be in slavery. And, in fact, under all law, consent is completely irrelevant to this crime. And we have to kind of wake up to that fact that there are, in fact, of course, people who choose to get themselves in tough and tricky and, you know, possibly illegal situations. But this is all about people who had no choice. Mm. And interestingly, a lot of them are in that situation for doing what you or I would do in the same situation. If our kids were hungry, if we were desperate for work, we might as well listen to the blandishments of a recruiter and end up enslaved in a country where there were riches that we could only dream of?
Well, I'm much more likely to be aware of a situation, a foreign situation, for example. I do buy free trade coffee because I know that that means that there was no slavery involved, or, you know, that nobody was ripped off, or at least I hope nobody was ripped off in the process. But how can I know whether some of the things that I'm buying that I would just assume are okay were made with slaves involved?
It's insidious. It really is. Our cell phones and our laptops contain an element called tantalum, which is made from an ore that is mined in the Congo quite frequently by slaves. Sometimes the oriental rugs we walk on in our homes come from India, Nepal, Pakistan, and were woven by one of 100,000 child slaves. The fruit, the vegetables that we already discussed that we bring to our table might very well have been harvested by a Mexican or Guatemalan or Honduran worker who's laboring under coercion. How do you know which ones are and which ones aren't? It's insidious. Sometimes you just don't.
It's tough, but we are working on it, and we certainly work with a number of companies and industries. Hmm. You have to trace those product chains all the way back to their taproot, because that's where the slavery actually occurs, right there at the farm gate or down the mine. Mm. And that's where you've actually got to deal with it. We've done a brilliant job, I think, working with the chocolate industry of doing exactly that, going all the way back, building a monitoring system, inspecting farms, certifying the chocolate.
Is that the cocoa protocol?
Yes, yes. But with many other areas, just before Christmas I was in Ghana. I was down illegal gold mines watching slaves hammer gold ore out of the ground. Gold that flows directly into the U.S. market for both investment and for jewelry. Absolute slavery with an incredibly high mortality rate. These young men would make it only 2 or 3 years before they died of silicosis. And yet there's, at this moment, no adequate inspection or monitoring system that would reach down to the local illegal mines and take that slavery away.
How does the Cocoa Protocol work?
The Cocoa Protocol is something of a revolution in that it's the first time an entire industry has decided to work together as opposed in competition to bankroll the work, which is in fact then determined not by the industry but by experts in child labor and anti-slavery work and agricultural sustainability.
I'm reminded that I saw a documentary in which they talked about people who are now only buying gold that has been redone, you know, old gold that has been remade into jewelry because they don't want to be part of a process in which slavery might very well have been involved. The 9th annual Trafficking in Persons report was published yesterday, wasn't it?
Yes.
That's right. From the State Department, it's actually a report on other countries, not our own country.
Although the good news is, I think, that it was announced that for the very first time, the United States will be holding up a mirror to its own conduct.
Because we have not been very critical of ourselves.
We're very good, Leonard, at pointing a finger. As you said earlier, it's happening in Moldova, it's happening in China. When people in America think of human trafficking at all, they tend to think of it abroad. And we are very poor at holding up the mirror. The reason Kevin and I wrote this book was to provide a mirror to the American public to show what's going on here.
Would you like to see another agency created, one that would just focus on this?
I'd like to see resources go to the agencies we've got. We've got a lot.
But if they're fighting each other,
well,
that makes it inefficient, doesn't it?
It certainly does. But maybe a czar who could whip them into line or something like that. But we are so under-resourced on this.
Yes.
It's very hard to understand. There's a phenomenal coincidence in that 17,000 people are brought into slavery each year in the United States. About 17,000 people are murdered in the United States each year. We have about 60,000 homicide specialists in the United States. We have about 40 trafficking and slavery specialists in law enforcement.
When Kevin and I are asked what we're after and what we feel the biggest lack in the country are, the first obviously is awareness, but the biggie after that is services, a lack of any services for
survivors.
Because
these people need psychological help.
They need psychological help. They need physical and mental health care. They need legal assistance. They need translation. They need job counseling, and they need shelter. And at this point, they're getting none of that, and it's tragic.
And I'm assuming that many of them suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Clinically.
The number to call in case you suspect that there is some human trafficking that you've spotted, the hotline is 888-373-7888. And you can also get in touch with any number of organizations, including the one that Kevin Bales is president of, Free the Slaves. That's based in Washington, D.C., and freetheslaves.net is their website. I want to thank the both of you so much for being on our show today, Kevin Bales and Ron Soudalter, S-O-O-D-A-L-T-E-R. Their book, The Slave Next Door, Human Trafficking and Slavery in America Today,